This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on December 6th, 2012. Should have questions if they're listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Amendment number 12-84, 12-83A, 12-78B, 12-81A.
Thank you. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it. The motion passes. Thank you. The next matter on the agenda is Draft Advisory Opinion 2012-37, Yamaha Motor Corporation. We have with us on the phone this morning Lisa McManus and Brian Tyson, both representing the requester. Are you on the phone?
Mr. Tyson? Mr. Tyson?
Good morning.
Good morning. I will turn you over to Chair Hunter.
Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Ms. McManus. Are you on as well?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Okay. Thank you for joining us. We'll start off with a presentation from the Office of General Counsel, Mr. Buckley.
Thank you, Chair Hunter. Good morning, Commissioners. Agenda Document 12-84 contains draft advisory opinions that respond to a request submitted on behalf of Yamaha Motor Corporation USA. Yamaha is a California corporation that is a wholly owned subsidiary of a foreign corporation. Yamaha asks whether it may establish a separate segregated fund and solicit contributions to that SSF from the executive and administrative personnel of a Yamaha division's dealers and service centers, as well as from the dealers and service centers that are individuals or partnerships. Both drafts conclude that Yamaha may create an SSF. The drafts differ, however, on whether the SSF may solicit Yamaha's dealers and service centers. Draft A concludes that Yamaha's SSF may not solicit contributions from the dealers and service centers because Yamaha does not maintain sufficient control over the business policies, practices, and procedures of its dealer service centers to conclude that Yamaha is affiliated with them. Draft B concludes that Yamaha's SSF may solicit contributions from the dealers and service centers because Yamaha does maintain sufficient control over the business policies, practices, and procedures of its dealers and service centers to conclude that Yamaha is affiliated with them. The Commission received no comments on the request and one comment on the drafts. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Buckley. And I'd also like to note that the deadline for this advisory opinion is January 4th, so we do have another open meeting between now and the deadline to consider it if we're not able to vote on this draft today. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Tyson or Ms. McManus? Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just would like to ask, I'll address it to both you, Mr. Tyson and Ms. McManus, just to get a little bit more clarification on the extent of the control that Yamaha has over its dealerships and service centers. You mentioned that advance approval is required of Yamaha before there can be any change in ownership or management of a dealer or service center. And Does that, in effect, give Yamaha a veto in the sense that if they were to change ownership or management without Yamaha's approval, that could lead to, I guess, maybe perhaps termination under the terms of the agreement? If you could provide a little bit more clarity and flesh that out a little bit more, that would be helpful.
And Commissioner, this is Brian Tyson. I think that authority definitely exists for Yamaha under the agreement, under the language. That Yamaha would definitely have the ability to terminate the agreement if change in management or control took place that they did not approve. Maybe Ms. McManus can offer a little more specifics on how it operates within Yamaha.
Yes, hi, this is Lisa McManus. The dealer agreement does provide that the dealer must provide us notice of any change in ownership or management, and we have to approve of any change of ownership or management. If we don't approve or if the dealer fails to provide us any notice, then Yamaha has the option of terminating the dealer agreement. There is a provision in 7.1, the last sentence, which says any transfer which is not made in accordance with this section is void. There's also Section 7.2, which discusses our rights to terminate as well.
Okay. And Is it also the case in both your requests and also in the comments after the drafts came out, you list all the different areas in which you have control over your dealership, over the dealers and service centers, including, you know, training of personnel, display of products, inventory, ensuring that, requiring that they service anybody who has bought a Yamaha product, and so on and so forth. And failure to comply with any of those could also result in termination?
That is correct.
Okay. One further question I have is on exclusivity. In 1.4 of the agreement, it has a non-exclusive provision talking about the rights granted herein are non-exclusive. Is this sort of a non-exclusivity provision fairly common in this sort of an agreement between either a franchisor or franchisees, distributors, dealerships, and so on?
I'll make sure I understand. Do you mean in an industry as a whole or within Yamaha?
To the extent you can comment on the larger industry.
And Commissioner, related to the non-exclusivity, related to the rights granted in the dealer agreement. So as far as just to make sure I understand, the reservation of rights that Yamaha has is to pursue additional rights available to it. Mr. McManus, can you speak to that anymore?
Okay. Yeah, that's because when I was looking at this, and I also was looking back at some of the other AOs we've had, for example, Dunkin' Donuts, they had a provision that was very similar to this in their in the agreement that they had with their franchisees as well. So I took it from that this sort of a provision in these agreements seems to be fairly commonplace.
Yeah, it gives us the right to sign additional dealers and not have exclusivity to one dealer.
And finally, just wanted to have you kind of flesh out your comments. You expressed concern about the focus in Draft A over exclusivity, and almost that becomes the dispositive factor, even though it's not listed as a factor in the affiliation provision in 100.5 of our regulations. When looking at, even though it's a non-exclusive list, it's a demonstrative list, yet exclusivity is not included there, but you expressed concerns that seems to be the primary focus in Draft A, and I just wanted to get your further thoughts on that.
Yes, Commissioner, and the concern there is that if exclusivity is going to become the rule, then it, in a sense, it'll be much easier to determine affiliation going forward. And if the rule is going to be exclusivity governs the issue, then it seems to be superfluous to have all the additional reviews of governance if the key question is the exclusive nature of the relationship.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Commissioner McGann.
Thank you. Just following up on Commissioner Peterson's point on asking about exclusivity. My understanding of the outboard motor world is you may have Joe's outboard motor and you walk in and they have the Yamaha section, they might have the Evinrude section, but that's just the way outboard motors have always been sold. And I guess it's not exclusive because they sell competing engines, but that to me is not fatal. But I'm also concerned. I agree with the comments. Draft A does really focus a lot on the exclusivity. But could you maybe help us factually, if my point makes any sense to you, about how outboards are actually sold? Because I think there's always a concern when you do an AO that you worry about what it means for the next guy and how this affects what's happening. And to me, the way outboards are sold is a little bit unique. It's kind of weird. There's no such thing as a little bit unique, but unique compared to right. other products. Because I don't think you have stores that are exclusive Yamaha outboard motors or exclusive Evinrude or exclusive Johnson or whoever else is out there. I think you always have sort of the marine products or maybe the outboard motor store that sells multiple brands, but yet still has a lot of control over how their particular product is sold. You get just going through the facts that I know. You have the district marketing manager who visits no less than quarterly. They can't use Yamaha as part of their corporate name, but they can use it in advertising so long as it complies with the manual that you give them. It seems to me you're exercising a lot of control over someone who's not exclusive. And I guess the question is this something that's just inherent in how you sell outboard motors? I mean, is it really realistic to actually say you could have an exclusive outboard motor dealership and you would still sell enough outboard motors to make it worth selling outboard motors? Or do you really need to do it the way you've been doing it, what I think has been for years and years and years and years?
Brian, I'll take a shot at this. I agree wholeheartedly with what you're saying. The marine industry is unique in that we do have a few exclusive dealers, but compared to the total number of dealers we have, that number is very small. And the reason being is that generally, unless you're in a certain area or market, a marine dealer needs to carry competitive lines in order to stay in business. And so you're right, the marine industry is unique in that situation where that is the norm, where exclusivity is not the norm. And
could I ask where the exclusive ones are?
A lot of them in Florida.
Because you can sell enough outboards to make a go of it being exclusive.
Right.
Okay.
Yep, a lot of them in the southeast and in Florida.
Okay.
The other question that you raised, or the other comment that you raised, was correct in that Yamaha still does retain a significant amount of control over the dealers, regardless of exclusivity, in addition to controlling the trademarks and the district marketing managers who are in there all the time and reviewing things and on our dealer agreements. Brian, did you want to comment further?
I think that's exactly what I was going to say. So perfect.
One final question factually. The application process that a dealer has to go through to become a Yamaha dealer, could you elaborate on that a little bit? It seems rather extensive. This is not a question where somebody can just declare themselves a Yamaha dealer and start selling engines, and then you're going to think you can solicit them for your pack. There's quite a bit of paperwork and quality control that goes into the process. Am I right on that?
Yes, you are correct. There is a new dealer packet, and the packet is quite extensive. It goes through an array of financial questions and business policy questions, and it also includes a review by the credit department, the finance department, the district marketing manager, the regional manager, and then the president of the Marine Group as well, to all approve the setup of a new dealer. It is a process.
Mr. Herman? Mr. Herman is our general counsel.
Good morning. I take it the operative provision that we're talking about in terms of exclusivity is 2.3. Am I right?
Yes.
Yes, that's correct.
And am I right that there's nothing in this agreement that precludes a dealer from having franchise relationships with other manufacturers in addition to Yamaha? So, for example, to use Commissioner McGann's example, a dealer could have a franchise relationship, at least under this agreement, with both Yamaha and Evinrude.
Correct.
Thank you.
And one additional point I'll raise, Mr. Herman, is that I think that since this is a licensee-type relationship as opposed to a franchise relationship, Ms. McManus can probably speak to whether that's standard in the industry or not, but I'm not sure that it would necessarily be a franchise relationship as opposed to they could have other licensing agreements with other manufacturers.
Commissioner McGann has a follow-up to that. That's okay. Commissioner McGann.
Let's assume we say yes, Yamaha can have a pack, and yes, you can solicit these folks. What if Evinrude has the same exact system and also wants to solicit these folks? How do you have any thoughts on how we deal with that? Because you're going to have Joe's Outboard potentially being within the restricted class of multiple PACs, which maybe that isn't fatal. I don't know. But it seems to me that you could have the same guys in a bunch of different PAC worlds.
Commissioner, I guess that's a possibility. I think the question will be, though, is the relationship that the dealer has with Evinrude as intrusive as the relationship with Yamaha? And sitting here today, I don't know the answer to that question, but it would appear that if a dealer is willing to surrender a significant amount of governance control, that they at least should be affiliated with the one that has the most surrender.
Commissioner Bowerly.
So would that mean if Evinrude came in and said, we require more specificity with respect to where you place our motors compared to the other motors, and that they could we find that there's an affiliation here, and then that could be trumped by a later request for affiliation from another entity by proving that they have more control than Yamaha does? I mean, would this become some... I think your suggestion is that you have a lot, and so you should have affiliation. But what if someone came in, Evinrude came in and exercised even more control? They wanted to control the color of the floor so that their engine, their motor stood out on the floor, and other details that are more akin to some of the things like the fairly rigid approach that Duncan takes to its franchisees. Would you suggest that we could revisit this question at that point in time?
Oh, no, Commissioner, I didn't mean to suggest that. What I meant to suggest was that if Evinrude exercises a similar level of control over a dealer that Yamaha does, then the way I would see it is they would have to be affiliated with both organizations. If the question truly is a governance question, and then from a practical perspective, I'm not sure a dealer would be able to surrender that much control to everyone if they're having to give financial reports to Yamaha and Evinrude and having to meet the requirements of Yamaha and Evinrude and everyone else. That's a significant intrusion on the day-to-day management. So from a practical perspective, I'm not certain if someone's willing to do that or if that's a practice in the industry.
And I was just throwing out Evinrude as an example. My family's always been Johnson Motors, so no offense to Yamaha, but that's just where we are. I wanted to a comment, because I want to make sure that you're not left with a misimpression of Draft A, although Draft A very clearly says significantly the exclusivity is absent. I think from my perspective in doing this analysis, exclusivity gives us sort of a shortcut to some of the issues at hand, including how much control of the day-to-day operations, how much control of the governance. Absent that, we just have to look deeper into the facts. And here, as I read your agreements, while it does have some requirements, again, at least as much prominence of your products versus any other that might be sold, obviously you retain use of your marks, which is pretty common in any contractual relationship. It just seems to me that comes down to a factual question of how much, I think the word you put, intrusion, and these are each affiliation question is very fact-based. So, and it's a little bit of a spectrum where you fall on the spectrum of how much control and versus how free a business owner is to operate their business in a day-to-day manner. I do have a question about management. When you say management and ownership, is there a level of ownership with each particular dealer that you look at? Is it the manager of the entire operation? Do you have any control over other employees in the operation?
The control generally, from a practical matter, is with the owners and the key personnel. And generally, the key personnel is the general manager and the managers of if there's, it depends on how the corporation is set up, but it's the owners, the general managers, and then the key managers, which would be generally service and sales.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that the question that Commissioner McGann raised about the, you know, what if Evinrude wants to do it too is a question that I also had been, it's an important question, and it's one that I'd been thinking about also. I mean, ultimately what we're grappling with here is how much control is enough control to pass the test under our regulations. And I think that's a question that different commissioners could come to different conclusions on. I think this may be a case of first impression. I can't recall another request like this where there wasn't an exclusive relationship. I mean, you know, Dunkin' Donuts only sells Dunkin' Donuts. They don't sell other people's. They don't sell Krispy Kremes at a Dunkin' Donuts franchise. Does council?
Anheuser-Busch was a beer distributor that also distributed other brands. And that's the closest analogy to this, but it's not directly.
Anheuser-Busch itself distributed.
No, they were seeking to make their wholesalers within their restricted class, and their wholesalers sold other brands besides Anheuser-Busch brands.
I have to admit that the thing that I most recall about that was that they wanted to give out beer they wanted to give out six packs as an incentive.
to the commission?
To I guess big pack participants.
We said yes.
We did. We said yes. You know, I think that exclusivity has to come into play at some point. And I don't know that this is actually a unique sales arrangement. I mean, there are a lot of companies that market their products in different ways. You know, there are some that will market exclusively through their own dealerships, and then there are others that will market both through their own dealerships and through other arrangements. I mean, I think about, for example, in the clothing industry, you can go to a Tommy Hilfiger store and buy only Tommy Hilfiger products, or you can go to Macy's or Nordstrom's and buy Tommy Hilfiger products there. I don't know that if Tommy Hilfiger wanted to come in and claim that the managers at Macy's or Nordstrom's were part of their restricted class, that we would find that particularly compelling argument. I don't think I would. I mean, you could take it to a silly extent, I suppose. I think I come up with these ideas in my head, and I think, well, that's a silly one. But then I'm reluctant to say, because maybe somebody wouldn't think it was silly. But what I think would be a silly example would be if the Slim Jim company wanted to say that every 7-Eleven manager was a member of their restricted class because they sell Slim Jims there, when obviously they sell all sorts of other things there, and there's no exclusivity there. So I think that would be a silly example. But my point being that it may not be the be-all and the end-all, but it's part of the it's implicitly part of the analysis, and goes to the level of and is related to the level of control that is exercised. I'm not sure that we've ever been asked whether somebody could be, you know, whether a dealer like this could be part of two restricted classes for two entirely different companies. I don't think so. No, okay, counsel's confirming on that, and I don't know that I would feel comfortable with that. I suppose the analogy would be more like in the trade association PAC world, where you know, it's not exactly the same, but, you know, somewhat analogous, where we say, you know, yes, you may be part of several trade associations, but you can only be part of the solicitable class for one of them. Do you have a comment on that, Commissioner?
I think the better analogy is members of corporate boards. You can be a board member of many corporations, and you're still within the restricted class of each corporation. Trade association rules are a little bit different. They're their own creature. So the idea of you're going to hit up the same person more than once is not foreign to campaign finance law.
Yeah, I guess it just whether you think the trade associations are more comparable to this than the corporate boards. I ask my colleagues how they. This is really not a question for the requester, but suppose Evan Rude did come in and say, "Well, we also exercise a certain degree of control." Would do you think that the same dealership could be part of the same of the restricted class for two separate manufacturers?
By analogy to the, you can have more than one person, you can have the same person on multiple corporate boards and therefore more than be a member of more than one restricted class, I think you could be. I mean, to get it even trickier, what if Joe's outboard decided to have their own pack? Right? And then could they do, well, they could, I guess, but yeah. I mean, how many Joe's outboards are really going to have packs? You know, I mean, Tommy Hilfiger is not selling marine engines that, you know, require maintenance and it's a different kind of. I think the marine industry, and that's why I was going with my questions. I think this is different. It's different than alcohol. Alcohol is, you know, a long history in this company, country of how it's sold, and sometimes for certain periods of time not sold, and then sold again. Wholesalers and distributors, and there's, you know, state taxes, and Virginia has that ABC board and all that stuff. So this really is. I think you're right. First time, this is case of first impression, and I think the way outboard motors are sold is different than how clothing sold and alcohol is sold. But yet, I mean, my guess is if Yamaha...
Slim Jims.
What's that?
Or Slim Jims.
Slim Jims, right. Yeah, that was a good one. I think we have consensus on Slim Jim would not make every 7-Eleven part of the restricted class. We take agreement where we can find it here.
That's for sure.
You know, part of this comes from me just because you know, I'm a creature of the East Coast and growing up near the water, and we're not a court. We're not limited to record evidence, and, you know, you don't think you put on an FEC commissioner because he knows something about outboard motors. I actually am a sailboat guy, not a motorboat guy, but and in that world, there's a big difference, a deeper divide than sometimes we have here at the commission. And that's why I was trying to get the requester to flesh out a little bit more factually why this is not I don't see this as something that goes beyond the world of marine motorboat engines just because of the way they sell it. Now maybe there is an analogous industry, but I can't think of one off the top of my head. And again, I bring to the table just walking into Joe's outboard and seeing the very prominent Yamaha display and all that, you know, the way they do advertising, and it all rings true to me, what the requester's saying, which is why the exclusivity thing doesn't scare me. Multiple restricted classes, that doesn't, unless someone has a reason, a precedent says you can't be in more than one restricted class, that's not a concern of mine on these facts. And I don't eat Slim Jim, so I really can't get into that too much. But some people think they're delicious.
Any other comments or questions for the requester? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Tyson and Ms. McManus. That was a very helpful conversation. We will not vote on this today, but intend to do so at the next public meeting, which is December 20th. And if it's okay with everybody, I'd like to note on our website, if possible, that we discussed it at this meeting and that we're accepting public comments until December 19th at noon. I think sometimes when we talk about something in an open meeting and then talk about it again, we need to make it a little bit more clear that we're willing to take comments from anybody, obviously the requester, but anybody else, and maybe note that on the website. Any other comments, questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The next item on the agenda is Draft Advisory Opinion 2012-35, Global Transaction Services Group. We have Mr. Michael Wofford here with us today. He's the president and CEO of GTS. Please join us. Thank you for coming from Omaha to be with us this morning. We appreciate it. We'll start off with a presentation from Mr. Esther Hayden. Mr. Hyden, sorry.
Thank you, Chair Hunter. Good morning, Commissioners. Before you are agenda documents 12-83 and 12-83A, which consist of two alternative draft advisory opinions responding to a request from Global Transaction Services Group, Incorporated. GTSG has developed a process to allow wireless users to make contributions of $50 or less using text messages and the wireless user's credit or debit card. A contributor will initiate a contribution by sending a text message and will complete the transaction by entering certain information into a web form accessed on his or her mobile phone. GTSG will collect only the contributor's credit or debit card number, expiration date, and security code. In its request, GTSG proposed depositing the funds received from the contributor's credit or debit account into GTSG's corporate treasury account before transferring the funds to the recipient political committee. GTSG asks whether it may process the proposed contributions using the wireless user's credit or debit card and forward them to recipient political committees. Draft A concludes that GTSG may process the contributions as proposed and forward them to the recipient political committees. Draft B concludes that GTSG may not process the contributions as proposed and forward them to the recipient political committees. We received no comments on the request and one comment from the requester on the drafts. Thank you. I would be happy to address any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Hyden. Any questions or comments? Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Wofford, for coming today. It's always helpful to have clarification. I appreciate your comment that you filed yesterday and wanted just to ask you, there's a couple of questions about the issues that you raised in there. First, on your first point of clarification about passing along the information that's available to you to the campaigns, you note that an extended process is available to utilize the phone number to derive the wireless account information, such as the donor's name and address. And I'd like you to share with me what do you mean text back and forth, or what's the extended process that you envision for your proposal?
That would be a back office process where you have the phone number and you just match it up with a database. So it's very similar to what's done today in the industry.
And you would your company would you do that, or would your company would do that and provide that as a service to your to your clients? And I imagine they'd be happy to have you help them in that process, because it takes a lot of time for campaigns to do that. The second point of clarification you noted in your comment yesterday dealt with how you deal with the contributions flowing through. And I think that I appreciated the clarification, because as I read your initial request, it sounded as if the you were using an account piece of accounting software that would track the contributions. This suggests you have two ways of actually segregating the funds from your general treasury. And again, well, that you would use one of these two depending on what your contract with the committee would prefer? Or is that you would just have both of those available to you at your discretion?
We have both available, and whatever the requirement is. So the second option that we talked about actually is a little bit tighter, and that is setting up a separate bank account for each committee, and we can do that. So, in fact, we do that in the charitable world today.
Okay. So. And then you also note that you could use the campaign's own existing credit card processor.
We could.
Okay, and that would you would do that depending on the particular campaign you're dealing with, or
well, we
you
would
make a decision.
We would lead with our own, solution first, but depending on the campaign and if they wanted us to use their existing processor, we could integrate and do that too. We would like to use ours first and integrate second, but
okay. Those were the questions that I had. Thank you.
Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I also appreciate your being here, and your comments were helpful. I want to make sure that we have the facts straight, because it seemed like neither of the drafts actually had the facts entirely right. So that's we can't give you a good answer if we're not clear on what the facts are. So I appreciate that. And I think that in whatever we do, we're probably going to, this will be another one that we probably won't be able to vote on today because we have to fix the facts. I think we're probably going to want to incorporate some of what you've told us into anything that we would ultimately vote on. Could you just unpack this sentence for me a little bit for those of us who aren't in the world of financial transactions? In your letter, you said as part of PCI compliant regulations. Not sure I know what that is. Personal card information such as name, address, and full card number are not available per well-established bank card transaction security standards. Could you elaborate a little bit on that? And as part of that, when you say they're not available, I mean, they must be available to somebody in the transaction, right? Somebody's got to know who's behind the credit card. So to whom are they not available?
So in the financial transaction world that's been developed for the last 30, 40 years, security has become tighter and tighter. And one of the things that you don't want to pass along in the financial transaction from the acquirer to the issuer is a lot of data that can be hacked or whatever. So the PCI compliance is an industry standard for the bank card world and banks and processors. And it dictates what you can put in and not put in messages. But in the financial transaction world...
I'm sorry, could you back up a little bit more? So PCI means...
It's the standard for a financial transaction that all banks and processors need to adhere to.
Does it stand for something?
It does. I'm not sure what PCI is.
It's one of those acronyms that achieves a life of
exactly.
its own. Okay. I'm sorry. I there was something else that you said that I wanted to ask about, but now I've forgotten already. So please continue.
But for instance, the processors, when they collect data and the transaction passes through, they cannot pass the name. So a credit card processor that collects on behalf of X merchants and passes the transactions to the bank that issued the card and gets the authorization, they cannot pass certain data in the transaction. They can only pass limited data, and that's
to
how
whom?
All processors, from the acquirer to the issuer. So in the financial world, there's always somebody that initiates the transaction, whether it's a merchant or a nonprofit or a political action campaign, and that's the acquirer. So you've got some data there, and you need to send it to the owner of that card, the bank account. That's the issuer. And so as that transaction's passed on to the issuer, there's very strict rules on the data that gets passed between the acquirer to the issuer who makes the decision if that can be authorized or not because there's money in the bank account. And then on the return transaction from the issuer to the acquirer, the same data is sent back in the same fashion. And that's what we were pointing out is that in the financial transaction world, there is no address and name that's passed in the transactions. They pass the amounts, and they pass encrypted card numbers. And then in the reports that come out at the end of the day from all the processors, you'll see here's all the transactions that are approved, here's the cards, but you'll only see limited data on each card, but you'll never see a name or an address.
So... you, as the aggregator, here somewhere in the middle of that transaction, what information do you have access to?
You have access to the amount that was approved, the time, the date stamp, and everything, and then you have an encrypted card number, and you actually have a little bit. They usually put the last four digits of the card in the actual reporting. So you know who that cardholder was through their card number and the amounts. And in the financial world, the cards are all coded for banks, BINs, MasterCard, Visa, all the BINs. So everybody knows where those cards go, who owns them, and where they started in the acquiring process, where they went to get authorized, and how it got back. All of that's very standardized, and so a card number actually tells you who is involved in the process, who authorized it.
And would you have the name, or do you only have the name because you're doing this through text messaging and you have access to the phone numbers?
That would be the latter,
right.
Yes.
Okay.
We do not have the name from the credit card side of it.
Right. It's your question is very interesting because we've got, as you may know, a line of opinions that dealt with credit card operations, and we have a more recent line dealing with text messaging, and what you're proposing to do is a little bit of both, which is fine. No problem there. It just, you know, we have to figure out how we do our analysis.
It's kind of like two different ecosystems. In the mobile world, you have certain data, and in the financial world, you have certain data. And then, how do you merge them and marry them, and what's allowed? So,
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Wofford, for being here. I have a question about the $50 cap, and could you provide just a little bit more information about how you will monitor, the amounts being raised? Are you using just the phone number? Are there other data pieces that you'll be taking in to try to ensure that the $50 cap isn't exceeded?
I think the phone number is the filter, and so we track everything to the phone number. And in the process, there's it's called a mobile payment gateway, that the transaction comes in from the mobile carrier. It goes off to the financial processor and comes back. So in that mobile payment gateway is where we would actually track the $50 aggregate.
Okay. Would you be using – so the other information that you'd be receiving, amount, date of payment, the last four digits, would that be used at all in terms of okay, so you would actually be – it wouldn't be just the phone number. You'd also be using that other information that you'd be receiving.
We would supply that to the political committee, yes.
Okay. Occasionally, one concern that has gotten raised in the text messaging realm is, the possibility of someone. I mean, it would take a lot of legwork, and I'm not even sure anybody would find it worthwhile to do. But the possibility of trying to find some sort of loophole in order to, make multiple contributions from different phone numbers, the same person using different phone numbers, or using, I don't know, I don't know what other loopholes might be out there, but what sort of mechanisms do you think you have in place that would defend against that potential to exploit that situation?
Well, that's exactly why I think we have to use the phone number itself, so we can track all the activity to the phone number. And then one of the questions that we had in the process of this advisory opinion was, can you block certain phone numbers, bad lists and things like that? And certainly we can do that. That's pretty standard in the financial industry. And if certain phone numbers are out there and there's bad number lists, we can do that. We can track to that. But back to your original question, I think you have to track it by each phone number. And that way you can mitigate the risk of different phones and different accounts and things like that.
And which as you pointed out, we permitted in the text messaging world. And it's your point that there's really no reason to apply a different standard to a situation that's close, maybe has a few factual differences from the situations we had presented in MCube and Revolution Messaging. But it's your point that this is... there's no reason why we would apply a different standard to you than we applied in those other situations.
Exactly.
Okay. Thanks.
Any other questions or comments? Okay. Oh, Madam Vice Chair.
I just want to say that in light of all the information that we have in front of us, it seems to me that what you're proposing should work for our purposes as well as for yours. I think we are going to have to do some redrafting, but we said in the I think it was in the MCube AO. I think we specifically said that there isn't only one way to do this, and you've come up with another alternative, and we always appreciate innovation, but it seems to have enough protections in it to cover any concerns that I have. I think, obviously the devil's in the details in writing these things down, but I think, from my point of view, I feel like we can probably get you a satisfactory answer.
If if I could make one comment, we do this today in the charitable world, the very process we so it works. And in the nonprofit world, the only difference is there's no $50 limit. Obviously, they would like to raise a lot more. So, but this is in production. It works fine in the non. So that's why we wanted to take this and apply it to the political campaign world, and we think it can be very helpful. So, thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us today. We will do our best to put out a revised draft as soon as we're able, and we'll consider this as well at the December 20th meeting, and we'll have it available for comment for both the requester and the public on until December 19th at noon. Thank you.
Thank you.
The next matter on the agenda is Draft Advisory Opinion 2012-36, Green Party of Connecticut. Mr. Buckley.
Thank you, Chair Hunter. Good morning again, Commissioners. Agenda document 12-82 contains a draft advisory opinion that responds to a request submitted on behalf of the Green Party of Connecticut. The Green Party of Connecticut is a political committee registered with and reporting to the Commission. It asks whether it qualifies as a state party committee of the Green Party of the United States. The draft concludes that the Green Party of Connecticut is a state party committee of the Green Party of the United States. Because the Green Party of the United States qualifies as a political party, the Green Party of Connecticut is part of the official structure of the Green Party of the United States, and the Green Party of Connecticut is responsible for the day-to-day operations of the Green Party of the United States at the state level. The Commission received no comments on the request or the draft. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Buckley. Are there any questions or comments? Is there a motion? Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move approval of the advisory opinion in response to the Green Party of Connecticut's request, AO 2012-36, as set forth in agenda document number 12-82.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it. Steve, did you say yes?
Yes.
6-0. Thank you. The next matter on the agenda is Freedom PAC Advisory Opinion. Mr. Levy is on his way here. He should be here momentarily. So without objection, we're going to move past that for a minute and go on to the next matter, which is the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking on Limited Liability Partnerships. And Mr. Buckley is back. He sort of left. Whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Chair Hunter. Good morning again, Commissioners. Agenda document 12-80 is a draft notice of proposed rulemaking regarding limited liability partnerships, or LLPs. The NPRM explains and seeks comment on proposed rules that would change how certain LLPs are treated under the Act and Commission regulations. If enacted, LLPs that opt for federal corporate tax treatment would be treated as corporations for purposes of the Act and Commission regulations. A corporate LLP would no longer be able to make direct contributions to candidates and political committees, but instead would be able to establish a separate segregated fund that could solicit contributions from the solicitable class. This SSF could make contributions to candidates and political committees. The draft provides for a 30-day comment period following publication in the Federal Register. Given the upcoming holidays, the Commission may wish to extend that comment period, and should the Commission approve the draft, we ask for authority to make any technical and conforming amendments. I will be happy to address any questions you may have.
Thank you. Are there any comments? Commissioner Walter.
Yes, I suggested this maybe a couple of years ago, and it's been sitting dormant. Basically, on the view that maybe we ought to be spending more time on other reg issues, which I agree with. But at this point, I think it's appropriate just to ask Commission to move this for comment and see where it goes. It really came to my attention when part of the reason we denied a previous request for this was because we didn't have a reg on it. But I think I'm willing to take this out for comment. I haven't decided for sure whether, depending on the comment, which way I would go. But so I think it's appropriate to let the public give us some input.
Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not going to. I'm certainly not going to object to our putting something out for public comment here. This, to the best of my knowledge, this issue has been raised once in the last decade, in the Holland and Knight AO request in 2008, I believe it was. So I'm not opposed to our taking on small issues. I think it would be better if we could do that in combination with taking on some of the larger issues. But it's not clear to me that this is actually is an issue that needs to be addressed at all, because it just hasn't been. We're not. I've checked in with our RAD analysts and our info people. We're not getting phone calls from people asking about this. As I said, I think it's only come up once in the last decade. So I think comments would be helpful, and I would support making it a 60-day comment period in order to get us through the holidays. And because I think the comments will be very helpful here. It's my concern with this is that we might get, you know, maybe one or two comments, and then we still won't really have a good sense of whether this is an advisable thing to do or not. Is there a need out there for us to change our regulations in this way? I'm really not sure. So I'll support putting it out for comment. As I said, I would support putting it out for a slightly longer period of time in hopes of getting more comments. I'm not sure where I'm going to end up at the end of the day.
Any other comments or a motion? Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you. I'll support. I assume Commissioner Walther will make a motion, and I'll support that, and 60 days is fine as well. I agree with something Commissioner Walther just said about we should be doing more regulations in terms of getting public comment, updating our regulations. There's a lot of issues that we should be dealing with, and I think an attempt to provide guidance to committees who have to deal with us. Last year, we put out an advance notice of potential rulemaking on things like internet disclaimers and what's required there to try to provide some guidance. I think I'm not certain how big of an issue is, but anytime someone is interested in trying to provide more guidance to people who fall within the jurisdiction and need to file with us, I think that's a good thing, so I'll support it. Commissioner Walther.
I agree. I think, first of all, if I thought this was going to interfere with any rulemaking effort that's taking place in our commission, especially down the Office of General Counsel, I'd pull this in a second. But unfortunately, we're not working as hard and as diligently as commissioners to move these issues along. And so I think we ought to consider in this situation updating our regulations in a number of ways, and so I think we could get a lot of things done without interfering with some of the things that are not getting done that personally I think we should try and move along, especially in the aftermath of Citizens United. Almost 3 years as of January 15th, 2013. It'll be 3 years since that's adopted. The Commission has not done anything to even ask the public for their comment on this massive change in campaign finance law. So once we begin to do that, then I think these things should go by the wayside. But in the meantime, I will move we approve this. For the 60-day period, it's certainly fine.
Okay.
Yes, and make plus all technical and conforming changes that can be made at the appropriate time.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye, of course.
All those opposed? The motion passes 6-0. Thank you. We will go back now to Draft Advisory Opinion 2012-34, Freedom Pack and Friends of Mike H. I see Mr. Levy has joined us. Thank you. I don't believe we have questions for you, but if we do, sir, we'll ask you to join us. Is there anything from the Office of General Counsel?
I do have a brief presentation.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Hunter. Good morning, Commissioners. Before you, there are three drafts. The response to a request for advisory opinion filed on behalf of Freedom PAC and Friends of Mike H. Drafts A, B, and revised draft A are presented as agenda documents 1278, 1278A, and 1278B, respectively. The Commission considered drafts A and B at the open meeting held on November 15. Revised draft A was released since the November 15th meeting. Drafts A and revised draft A conclude that Freedom PAC may accept a contribution of $10,000 or more from Friends of Mike H. Draft B, on the other hand, concludes that Freedom PAC may not accept a contribution of $10,000 or more from Friends of Mike H. because Friends of Mike H. may not make contributions in excess of $5,000 per calendar year to Freedom PAC. The Commission received one comment on the advisory opinion request and three on the advisory opinion drafts, and I'll be happy to address any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Levy or comments? Is there a motion, Madam Vice Chair?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move approval of revised draft A in AO 2012-34 as set forth in agenda document number 12-78B.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion passes 6-0. Thank you. Next matter on the agenda is proposed final audit report on Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party A09-08. We have discussed this audit before and gone back and forth with some revisions, so I don't want to preclude any conversation, but if there's no other, is there any questions or comments on this audit? Is there a motion? Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Various commissioners put in a few edits into the audit report to more accurately reflect their own points of view as portrayed in the report, and that's really the only changes that were made. They were fairly minor. So just as a point of explanation for anybody out there who's wondering what's going on, having said that, I move that we approve the proposed final audit report on the Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party, audit 09-08, as set forth in agenda document number 12-81A.
Thank you. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion passes 6-0. Thank you. The next and last item on the agenda for today is the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on McCain-Palin 2008 and McCain-Palin Compliance Fund. Presentation this morning?
Yes.
Whenever you're ready. Thank you.
Good morning. Before you is the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum for the McCain-Palin 2008 McCain-Palin Compliance Fund. The memorandum recommends the Commission find the method of billing a press during a campaign did not result in material harm. The memorandum also recommends the Commission find that McCain-Palin Compliance Fund, Inc. failed to file 48-hour notices for contributions totaling $240,700 that were received prior to the general election. We're ready to take any questions.
Thank you. Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of questions that deal with the travel issue. We had a hearing with the committee earlier this year on this issue, and I'd like to ask our Office of General Counsel and the Audit Division about the recommendation that's in this memorandum. The recommendation is the Commission find the method of billing the press during the campaign did not result in material harm. And I'm hoping to get a little more information about what material harm, what that standard means in this context.
I'll try to start off on that, and then I will turn it over to our colleagues in the audit division. After the public hearing, it struck us that where the commission seemed to be, judging from the comments of commissioners during the hearing, was that the finding in the draft final audit report could be approved if the auditors could be more specific about whether and the extent to which any of the following things had happened. One, the general committee effectively subsidized the primary committee, which would be an impermissible use of public funds for the privately funded primary committee. Or if two, the primary committee effectively subsidized the general committee, which would be a receipt of private funds by the publicly funded general, which it couldn't do, or if the general committee essentially had accepted private funds from the press, which also would be in the realm of accepting impermissible private funds, not to mention the fact that it would, you know, while it's not the primary issue here, we do have this rule and that also tries to keep the general, for the press from being, to be colloquial about it, from being ripped off by a committee. So we advised the auditors that we thought they ought to address all of that in the ADR. And I will let them discuss their conclusions, but I understand them, if I'm correct, to be that while the methodological issue, we haven't really changed our position on, and neither have they, that in terms of that level of harm, they either, for those three things, either couldn't find any or perhaps with respect to one or two of them, maybe we're able to find some, but not that rising to a level that in their auditing judgment would be material. And I'll turn it over to the auditors to expand on why they reached that conclusion.
Yeah, that's correct. And in the first instance or the first circumstance with the press materially subsidizing the campaign, we went back and we looked at those press entities that traveled in the general period versus who traveled in the primary period, and essentially there were a lot of they were the same entities in most cases. There were some that only flew in either, but the amount of reimbursement due to those organizations was low on both sides, so we didn't come up with any sort of material result there. And then number two, the general committee exceeding the expenditure limit, we determined that through the course of the audit that there was no limitation issue whatsoever. And then in the third area, the primary committee financing the general committee, we kind of stepped back and took a broader perspective, a broader look at our calculations, looking through kind of the prism of what happened at the hearing as far as looking at the numbers holistically over the entire campaign. And if you did that, then there probably was not an imbalance in the amount owed back to the press.
One general comment on this, the hearing process. From my perspective, and others may disagree, we set up this hearing process so that committees would have a chance to come in and discuss issues in the audit with the commission. I have never personally viewed this as a place where I need, as a commissioner, to identify my positions on particular things, because I want to actually be open to making sure I can hear everything that the committee was. So it's not clear to me that
while some commissioners may choose to identify their particular legal positions or conclusions as to facts during an audit committee and or audit hearing, they're entirely entitled to do that. I think it, from my perspective, I try to be open-minded, and I usually want to take time to reflect on what I heard and understand and go back and look at things more. So I think, frankly, it's a little difficult to say that that the audit hearing in every instance would coalesce the issues and that you would have a firm view of what at least I as a commissioner would be thinking. I think that's one of the challenges with this process is that you can, you know, it also could be the fact that, you know, if the schedule happened to work out where someone was unable to come or there were some instance where they wouldn't come, that commissioner's views would then somehow not be included at all in your further thinking on things. So I think that would be just a sort of a general area of caution into what to read into that, at least as far as I'm concerned, and others might have different views about that process. But I try to remain as open as possible to the arguments that the committee is making and want to reflect on those after the fact. But as I understand your explanation, you basically went through each of these, and while there was some subsidization from the press, you don't think it was significant enough to be material? Is that your...
Looking at it over the course of the entire campaign.
Of both campaigns, mm-hmm. even though this audit is only for the general campaign.
Correct.
Did you ever boil that down to a number? The regs, you know, have 110% as the limit for reimbursements. Did you come up with a number that you think
when you combine
to that you can attach to the general?
Yes, we did. And when you combine the primary and the general for Swift Air, it actually comes down to the press underpaying by $67,000.
Right, but we didn't audit the primary.
Correct.
So in the general, did we do that? If we didn't, that's fine. I'm wondering if you did a calculation to figure out how much was in the general.
For the general, if we don't take into consideration any of the other modes of transportation used in the general, you're looking at $537,000. When you take into consideration all the modes of transportation used in the general, that's how we come up with the $344,000 that's in the audit report.
Right. I was trying to understand whether we're at all close to the 110% set forth in the regulation, or if it's they were reimbursing at 180% of the cost. Well, because we do allow in the regulation for a little more, because obviously right. there's staff time, there's a lot of other things that can get rolled into that we obviously don't require the campaigns to wind up funding the press's travel either. This is trying to approximate some
I hope I'm understanding this correctly, but the committee billed on 106%, okay. which was under the 110. When the audit did its calculation, we based it on 110%. But when you combine both areas,
so you're saying the 300 is what's over
correct.
One
over the 110.
Got it. Okay. Okay. I think those are all my questions for now.
Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a little confused. If the audit only covered the general, why, and the general is a different entity from the primary campaign. For one thing, one was publicly financed, one was privately financed. So have we ever, you know, have we ever done this before where we combine the primary and the general period during an audit of one or the other and drew our conclusions based on the entire campaign rather than the piece that we're actually auditing?
I think this is the first time we've kind of had the situation where one was publicly funded and the other one was privately funded in under Title 26 or Title 2 for that matter. But so, yes, it's a unique circumstance. So, you know, when we went out and did the audit, we were focused on the general committee. But we knew full well that one of the explanations in the contract itself that the committee signed was for the entire period. So we did a little extra work to try and look at it and have the information for us to be able to provide everyone the perspective of the entire campaign.
And I appreciate the work that you did, and I know that it also was raised in the audit hearing, but I guess my question is from a maybe it's really from a legal standpoint. Is it appropriate to combine the two periods of time when applying our regulations about whether it's above or below the 110%?
Madam Vice Chair, I would say I think that our view of what's legal has not changed from the advice that we had provided the audit division at the time of the DFAR. That we're not saying that the committee used necessarily a reasonable method or that people ought to do what the committee did in future campaigns.
That may not be a problem.
And that may not be a problem. You're right. I think there's a difference in terms of making a judgment about legality and making a judgment about materiality. And we would defer to the auditors on whether or not in their auditing judgment a particular level of harm is material or not.
Well, materiality could be a legal threshold. I mean, it is a term that lawyers talk about. But you're saying that in this context, it's not a legal determination?
It's an auditing determination.
It's an auditing determination as to whether it's material. And I want to be clear about I guess I go back to the question that Commissioner Bowley had at the beginning about what it actually means to say that it didn't result in material harm. The 300,000 plus discrepancy? Would that be a what would be the best way of describing that?
Refund due the press?
Well, that number, okay. If you looked at that as a proportion of the entire press payments that were, I think, the subject of this audit, it was something like $4 million. Yeah. Is that right? Press travel payments?
Yes, $4 million.
So, I mean, I don't know whether this is the appropriate calculation to make, but, I mean, sort of my shirt cuff calculation of $300,000+ out of $4 million sounds to me like maybe it's an 8% roughly discrepancy there. I certainly wouldn't be on board with a conclusion that 8% is not a material difference. Is that what you're saying, or is that not what you're saying?
Well, I don't think we looked at it from the 8% perspective. We took it straight from the regs, and it would be the 110%, and anything over the 110% is considered that's the threshold. That is due back.
And it is over 110.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't
think for looking over the general period. So that's where the
right.
340,000 comes from.
But that's what you were auditing, was the general.
Exactly.
So in order to get to the conclusion that there's no material harm, you have to look at you have to combine the primary and the general periods, despite the fact that one was publicly funded and one was privately funded, and they are, you know, legally separate operations.
Legally, yes.
And they have different contribution limits, and they have different all of the other restrictions that come to bear are separate for those two, mm-hmm. for the primary and for the general.
Correct.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, what's the rationale for combining them?
Well, I think in a large part it was in response to the committee's response to the original issue when we brought it up during field work, and then they, of course, also brought it up during the hearing. And upon the guidance of the Office of General Counsel, we went back and looked at it from a different perspective, looking over the entire campaign and combining the primary and the general and trying to determine whether or not there were harm in those three areas.
Is it's not an entirely satisfactory answer for me, because what I'm hearing from different people in the building, and we ought to try and at the end of the day, the audit report has legal conclusions as well as auditing conclusions in it. Is that for, you know, legally, we seem to think that these are two separate periods of time covering two, you know, then they ought to be kept separate. But for auditing purposes, for the purpose of this audit report, we're combining them in order to reach this conclusion that there's no material harm.
In this recommendation, we are, but in the actual audit report by the staff, the conclusion is the $340,000 to be paid back to the press.
Commissioner Walther.
Well, just is this mostly just a result-oriented analysis? Because let's be candid, and I thank you for your candid comments, but. Why would we use materiality and stretch that over two campaigns when we talk about legally? We're really only talking about the general.
Again, we did it in response to the hearing, and the guidance that we received from the Office of General Counsel was to go back and look at it from a more global perspective and try and determine whether or not the calculations and the math would and what kind of answer we would get in each of those three areas that we have in the recommendation.
Well, so your legal analysis initially was we would look at it straight for the general only.
Exactly. The legal analysis that was performed on the auditor's reports were based solely on the general committee. Okay. However, the issue was brought up very early during audit field work, and then we've been bouncing it around for a very, very long period of time.
But then Mr. Calvert's just telling us he agrees that really from a perspective of analysis, we should be looking at the general, except if we may be looking at it on a materiality basis. And I'm not sure where's the legal basis for doing that, to defining materiality over a period of both campaigns.
I think that's a legal question.
Well, actually, I think the reg is actually doesn't go into exactly how you do it when you have two campaigns using one single transaction. And the problem that we had is that the auditors had one calculation and the committee had another calculation. Then you have a regulation that allows the committee to take a reasonable estimate. So when you have a divergent calculation and there's no guidance, you know, it's very hard to say that the committee is incorrect in the way they did it and the auditors are correct, or vice versa. So that's what we actually have. So you have this divergence in calculations, but the reg allows them to take a reasonable estimate. So if you have a divergence in calculations, it's very hard to say that theirs is wrong. But if you use the auditor's calculation, you could say, yeah, that the press, you know, subsidize the campaign, or maybe you could say that one committee subsidized the other, but you just have a difference in calculations. There's no guidance to actually how you do the calculation in terms of what is the actual cost.
Madam Vice Chair.
I'm not sure about that. Because it seems to me that there is a legal question there, and there is a legal answer to it as to whether, I understand completely from the campaign's perspective, they've got one contract, and you know, with the benefit of hindsight, you can see exactly how many hours were used, and obviously they were making this determination on an ongoing basis of, you know, based on estimates of how many hours they're going to be using each week. That's always complicated. I get that. We don't want to be second guessing them with the benefit of hindsight. Having said all of that, there's, you know, this question of what's the time period? You know, does it include the just the general, or does it include the primary and the general? It seems to me that that is ultimately a legal question that I think there is an answer to, and that that legal answer has to inform the audit report's conclusion.
I I think that is a legal question, but if you look at the regulation, it doesn't say when you have this type of transaction, you have to base it solely on one committee. It's not that specific. It just what 9004.6B1 says is that you need to determine a pro rata, and you can use a reasonable basis to determine a pro rata. But there's no engagement with respect to what happens when you have a single transaction that involves more than one committee. And that's what we have here.
Well, I mean, it's not a single transaction. It was a contract with a single vendor. But it's not, I mean, obviously they were there every week they made a new calculation.
No, not in the sense of making payments as a transaction, but overall a contract that involves two committees. That's what I mean by a single transaction. But the commission wants to say that as a matter of policy, whenever you have a situation where you have more than one committee, we're going to rely solely on the calculation with respect to that committee that's subject to the audit, then I think that's a policy question the commission determined. But I don't think that's currently in the regulation.
You had the site there just a second ago. Can you remind me again?
9004.6B1. And B2.
Madam Vice Chair.
Okay, so let me ask you a question about that. So it starts off, 9004.6A starts off talking about expenditures by an authorized committee. An authorized committee. Are the primary and the general committee together an authorized committee, or are they two separate committees?
No, I think it's one separate committee, but
One separate committee? No, it's either two separate committees.
It's one committee.
It's one committee. Okay.
But I think the dispute here is not 9004.6A. The dispute is 9004.6B1 and B2. That is the regulation that tells you how to calculate pro rata share. The problem that we have is if you look at B2, it does not define what is actual cost. And that's the core here. What is the actual cost? So are you going to base actual costs on, you know, viewing it with respect to one committee or two committees?
Well, which is it? Is it one committee or is it? Now, first, you just said it was one committee. Is it one committee or is it two committees?
No, that's what I'm saying. You know, the committee looked at it with respect to what? The committee looked at it with respect to one transaction involving two committees. The auditors broke it apart as, you know, two committees. And that's how they got divergent calculations in terms of how do you calculate actual costs.
Is it one committee or is it two committees? There's got to be an answer to this question, right?
Is what one committee or is what two committees?
The primary and the general, the entire McCain operation, okay? Was it one committee or was it two committees?
It's two committees.
It's two separate committees.
Yes.
Okay. That's what I thought. Just wanted to be clear. Everybody agrees on that? It's two separate committees?
It's two committees.
Okay. So I think 9004.6B has to be informed by 9004.6A, which starts out talking about expenditures by an authorized committee. What in B would make us think that now we're talking about more than one authorized
committee? Because this transaction involves more than one committee. determine actual costs. If there were three committees for some reason, then we would still need to determine actual costs. And so how do you divide it when you have more than one committee? That's the question. How do you determine actual costs? I think it's pretty easy. It's pretty straightforward if you have one committee, but they didn't have a transaction that had one committee. They had a transaction that had two committees. And so I'm not saying that, you know, what the auditors did is correct, but I'm also not saying what the committee did is correct, because you have, they can use a reasonable estimate.
Commissioner Bowerly.
So is it the general counsel's office position that they exceeded 110% or not? I hear your point about reasonable estimate, but at the end of the day, we have a reg that says you can only seek reimbursement up to 110%. So now I'm confused. I thought there was some agreement that they exceeded that and the way we were going to deal with it. Because I think stepping back from this, you can, there's a legal question, and then there's what do you do about it if it's wrong? And the what do you do about it seems to me, to, from my perspective, to go to this idea of material harm, whatever the harm might be from this. And maybe that's where this comes into. But we have a threshold legal question of, did they exceed the 110%?
I believe the answer to that question is yes. If you look at the general committee and you look at the allocation methodology, they exceeded 110%. That's correct.
Okay.
But the question becomes whether or not the committee used an unreasonable methodology in arriving at the number they arrived at. The auditors have their view as to what's the correct methodology. The committee's argument was their methodology was not unreasonable. And looking at whether or not that was a valid argument, we suggested to the auditors that they look at whether or not ultimately there was any material harm in determining whether or not the committee's methodology was unreasonable. But to answer your question, yes, they exceeded 110%.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I hear the argument of, and I agree with Commissioner Weintraub, is this is all easier after the fact when you're, you know, paying bills on the fly. And, you know, I'm not suggesting what they did was unreasonable as a way of running the operation. But our question is, I think what the agency has to decide is whether they complied with this requirement of not seeking reimbursement over 110%. The fact that it was perhaps another not unreasonable at the time that they did it seems to me to go towards what do you do about it if it's a problem. But it seems to me that we have a problem under the reg in terms of the amount of reimbursement.
I think that's correct.
Thank you.
Commissioner McGann.
Question, it's not going to sound related, but it is. The joint fundraising committees, did they raise primary money?
Yes, I believe so.
So if yes. The audits of the general committee, then what were we doing looking at joint fundraising committees that were raising primary money?
Well, that was that we went back historically to see whether under Title 26 and the authority that we had to audit them, whether we should do the joint fundraising committees or not, and the determination was made back then that they would be included.
Right.
So it was kind of historical. We've done it in the past.
When you use the elusive passive voice, that the determination was made by the auditors, not the commission. The point I'm making is this idea of some rigid line between the primary committee here and the general committee here. If that's the case, why is no one jumping up and down about the joint fundraising committees? Because it seems to me, if we're going to draw a bright line and say, well, the fact the committee used one contract to figure out how to pay the media, if that doesn't fly, then how can we have something in the audit report for something that isn't general election? It's primary. I mean, it's for the sake of argument, is somehow related. Let's assume the auditors were proper in doing it. There's other examples where this rigid line and this question of one or two committees doesn't really matter, right? I mean, isn't this part of the same sort of the way you do things? It's not a trick question. I mean, I'm sort of backing you up here on looking at the, you know, you have one contract that sort of extends primary to general. The joint committees are kind of in the same ballpark, aren't they? I mean, potentially it would have affected the general campaign, but it didn't. So,
yeah, I mean, our
Our focus was the general period, and the joint fundraisers were added as and discussed. And, I believe, if I remember correctly, the commission was informed that we were adding those to the scope of the audit at the time. So,
well, informing is not the same as commission approving. I'm not beating up on this point. This was this was not you. It was your predecessor. Just to put a fine point on it, and I'm not using this format to pick on that decision per se. What I'm, the point I'm making, though, is even within this audit, there's activity that was not general election activity that was part of the audit and is in the audit report. Right?
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
Has there ever been an example where we've taken a contract that goes from one to the other, from, you know, where they've tried to bridge a decision on what happened during the primary versus the general?
Specifically,
maybe your audits don't, you know, audits in the past are all merged, are they? I don't know if they are or not. Are they? You have an audit for the primary and an audit for the general?
Well, specifically with air travel, you know, I think this is the first time that we've had a publicly and a privately funded campaign where this has occurred.
Right, but in the old days, in the old days when everybody was taking public financing and you audited, what did you do? Did you audit separately or did you audit?
We looked at them.
Did you try and?
We looked at them separately. Back then,
right.
And then
so,
especially since the Bright Line regulations, I think we've not only travel, but in other areas, we've really separated the two entities.
Right. Well, I would assume that. And I was just wondering, what policy did you follow in the past when you had something like this? You had a lease with some rent obligations or something. Rent probably wasn't a big issue, but say a lease or anything that had variable monthly payments. Did you have any experience with that even in those days when you had... You know, were you doing both?
Yeah, we would, you know, sometimes there's like security deposits and things like that attached to rent contracts and whatnot. And in those cases, we would calculate how much is owed back to the primary and vice versa if it went the other way. So we kind of reconciled it out between the two campaigns or committees, I should say.
Any other questions or comments? I believe that at least three commissioners are prepared to vote, but I don't... Okay, my understanding is that not everybody's prepared to vote at this moment, and some people have to leave for a previous engagement. So we're going to take a recess for lunch and come back a little bit late at 2:30. I hope that's okay for everybody. So without objection, we will stand in recess and return it. Does that work? Does that time work for everybody? Okay, we'll return at 2:30. Thank you. Good afternoon. The commission meeting for Thursday, December 6, 2012 is back in session. Thank you for joining us again. When we went on our break last time, a little while ago, I was speaking with counsel to the committee, Mr. Sanderson and Mr. Keith Davis, and I wanted to apologize to them that they would have to come back yet again after lunch, and they said at that moment that they would like to address the commission on this issue. My understanding from the Office of General Counsel is there's no procedure for or against that, but that if it's the will of the commission, then that's okay.
They may address the commission if there are four votes that permit them to do so, yes.
Okay. I'm in favor of allowing the committee to address the commission at this time. I realize that we've already had an audit hearing on this issue, but there's a new document that's been released since then, and because counsel requested to do so, I'm in favor of it. And I believe that there are at least three people that are willing to allow that. Commissioner Walther?
Well, she worked me over pretty good. And my concern is starting a new rule that, becomes the order of the day. But I think in this case, we've taken 4 years. I think we can take 15 minutes. I did suggest that 15 minutes might be appropriate to give us your legal arguments on what you'd like to, what we're missing, what you think we're missing. So I'd support that.
Okay. Do we need a formal motion?
I think a formal motion would be advisable, yes.
Was that a... yes, there's a comment before the motion, Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not going to support the motion. We worked out an arduous process. It took us a year to come up with a process for these audits. It allows for... multiple opportunities for counsel to interact with the commission on paper and in person. We had an audit hearing, and I think we are at the decision point. I'm not aware of any other adjudicators who, when they're at the decision point, say, oh, counsel, you want to come on down and give us one last shot before we make up our minds? I I'm generally opposed to sort of ad hoc changes to our procedures, so I will vote no.
Mr. Bowerly.
Thank you. I share the concerns with respect to both the procedure and the actual substance. We had a hearing. It was, and I think that the audit hearing process is a good tool. It's useful to give people a chance to come in and explain their legal positions during the audit process. But we're past that point now, and I don't think the issues before us are going to be illuminated by anything council might have to say. The discussion this morning was really focused on what the audit division recommended and its own analysis and our general counsel's analysis that supported that.
Thank you. Is there a motion? Commissioner McGann?
I guess so. I move that... representatives of the audited committee are permitted to appear before us and address issues that they think may be salient in light of our discussion earlier concerning this audit.
Thank you. And one commissioner requested that it be short. Thank you. All those in favor?
Is that the motion, that it be 15 minutes?
Is that a friendly amendment, that it be 15 minutes?
Sounds friendly to me. I hope it takes five.
It's friendly enough for me, too.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion passes 4-2. Mr. Sanderson?
Well, thank you, Commissioners, for allowing me to address a few issues that were touched on earlier this morning during the first part of the hearing. As was mentioned, we've been discussing these issues for 4 years, so I will keep my my remarks relative to a few, two different issues that I saw that were key, and they will be, and my remarks will be brief. During the initial session, the commission staff was asked whether it was appropriate to consider the primary portion of the Swift Air contract, given that the commission was auditing the general committee and not the primary committee. I did want to share with you, the committee does not and has never argued that the auditors should expand the scope of their their inquiry in order to agree with the committee's position. As we see it, the question at issue is, what is the total actual cost of each travel segment that occurred during the general election period? Now, as we've said in our filings, how do you figure out what the total actual cost is? Either predicting the total actual cost, what it will be, or in hindsight, saying what it was. Well, the total actual cost is made up of variable costs and fixed costs. The single most significant fixed cost for the general committee was the $6.3 million contract for an airplane that it held, for a jointly held asset in the form of an airplane. It was an asset that it held jointly with the primary committee. This is not a novel situation. Multiple committees frequently share single assets. And the commonality of that arrangement is really reflected in the commission's rules, in principles it is forwarded over the years and in several precedents. So what the committee was trying to do was figure out how much of, in aggregate, how much of the $6.38 million should be borne by the general committee. And in the absence of a rule, it looked to several different principles that the commission has forwarded in the past, such as benefit derived. The commission staff actually seemed to recognize that the committee's calculation reflected the benefit derived by saying in the preliminary audit report that the campaign's calculation method reflects the comparative actual use of the aircraft between the primary and general committees. So that was the logic behind the calculation method. That was recognized, in our opinion, by the commission staff as being valid. Another place that the commission's typically looked on how to allocate costs for a joint asset held by multiple committees, they've also looked at gap principles, and that has been an endorsed approach in at least one past audit situation. The staff was also asked this morning, one other place that the committee looked to determine its calculation method was actually past audits. The committee staff was asked this morning whether it had ever been the case where they saw a contract that straddled the primary and general election periods. Well, as we note in our filings, that actually was the case, and the committee's compliance staff did rely on the past acquiescence of audit staff. In the Bush 2000 campaign, there was a very similar type of contract. It was the total actual cost for each travel segment for that contract was calculated in an identical manner by the same exact people involved in 2000 and in 2008. So we believe that is a matter of precedent. So that's one issue that I wanted to address. The other issue was the commission staff was asked whether the committee had received more than 110% of the total actual cost in the form of reimbursement for the press. We do not believe that's the case, and the reason why is an issue of timing. Inherent in the rule is, you know, when will the commission make this determination? When will it decide whether the committee has received, the general committee has received more than 110% of the reimbursement that it's entitled to? Well, what we're saying is, though it may be the case now, that determination is premature because the allocation of the cost has not yet been rebalanced. The Office of General Counsel recognized that the General Committee received reimbursements from the press, quote, for a portion of the travel costs that the Primary Committee paid to Swift Air for primary campaign transportation attributable to the primary campaign. In other words, the General Committee at this time still has money that is attributable to an outlay made by the Primary Committee. We would ask that before the committee makes a determination, the commission makes a determination on whether the committee has received more than 110% of the reimbursement value, that it be afforded an opportunity to rebalance the reimbursements and return the primary funds to the primary committee. Those are the two issues that I wanted to address. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. And there's 9 more minutes left on the 15-minute clock. So any other?
I tried to keep it to 5.
You did good. It's close. Any questions or comments for Mr. Sanderson? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Any other comments? Is there a motion? Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move approval of the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on McCain-Palin 2008 and McCain-Palin Compliance Fund as set forth in Agenda Document Number 12-77.
Thank you. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
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 Motion fails 3-3. Any other motions? Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we'll try breaking up the issues. Maybe we'll find some agreement on something. I'll make a motion, and then I'd like to make one comment about the motion. The motion is... I move that the Commission find the General Committee received press reimbursements during the general election campaign period which exceeded the maximum allowed under 11 CFR section 9004.6B. And my comment on the motion is that this is just a legal conclusion. I think this is the legal conclusion that our lawyers came to. I think it's also the conclusion that our auditors came to, and then they went beyond that in their recommendation to say what the consequence of that should be. This doesn't say what the consequence is. This doesn't say what the remedy is. I personally would not be in favor of the General Committee reimbursing the Primary Committee. I think if there were to be a remedy, the money would more appropriately be reimbursed to the press. But this doesn't really get there. The motion doesn't address what the next step is. It just seeks to establish the point of law.
Any other questions or comments on any other comments on the motion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. Motion fails 3-3. Any other motions? Madam Vice Chair?
Thank you. It's my understanding that issue will now go to additional issues. But perhaps we can agree on the second recommendation in the memorandum. Hang on a second. I'll make sure I find it and word it properly. I move that the Commission find that the McCain-Palin Compliance Fund, Inc. failed to file 48-hour notices for contributions totaling $240,700 that were received prior to the general election.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion passes 6-0. Thank you. I think that concludes Madam Vice Chair?
Actually, there's something else that requires a little bit of explanation, I think. There's an issue that was raised, and I'm sorry, this may be the first time that Mr. Sanderson is hearing about this, that was raised over a year ago at the preliminary audit report stage. And it goes to the reason why there's no finding in this audit report about the expenditure limit. The commission had a debate on the treatment of hybrid ads. It's not a new issue for the commission. It's an issue that the commission has deadlocked on in the past and deadlocked on again at the preliminary audit report stage. Some of us would have preferred to have had it in the report so as to provide the committee with the opportunity to see the issue and respond to the issue. They didn't get that opportunity because it never made it into a report for lack of four votes. However, what we did vote to do back in September of 2011 was to place the preliminary audit report along with the cover memo and certain attachments on the public record, which explained this hybrid ad issue and the views of various commissioners on it. I think that was a unanimous vote. I think that's appropriate to have those documents on the public record to explain where commissioners were and why the expenditure limitation issue kind of evaporated. As I said, I would have preferred that we had been able to put it out there for respondent to not respondent for the committee to comment on. But I wouldn't want you to be completely surprised when these documents show up on the public record. Whoa, where did those come from? So that's where they came from, and those documents will be placed on the public record at the conclusion of the audit.
Anything else? Then the audit division will prepare the proposed final audit report and circulate that. Any other issues on this audit? If not, Ms. Orrick, are there any management and administrative matters to discuss?
There are none.
Hearing none, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.